You see, you can't translate new speak. Even the party slogans are changing. How will you say freedom is slavery when the word freedom no longer exists? I see, Winston, this is a point. Winston, the whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought.
To narrow the range of thought?
In the end, we'll make thought crime literally impossible because there'll be no words to express it.
That's excellent, but even now there's no excuse for thought crime. It's just a question of reality control, of self-discipline.
When newspeak is perfect and compulsory, there won't be the need even for that. The revolution will be complete. Have you ever thought? In 70 years or so, there'll be nobody alive who could possibly understand this conversation we're having.
In public, Greenspan was inscrutable whenever Congress asked about interest rates. He resorted to an indecipherable Delphic dialect known as Fed speak.
I would engage in some form of syntax destruction, which sounded as though I were answering the question, but in fact had not.
We showed him a tape of him at a hearing.
Modest preemptive actions can obviate the need of more drastic actions at a later date, and that could destabilize the economy. Very profound.
Very profound. Impenetrably profound. And so you worked on these, right?
Oh, of course.
You worked on making it even more. But what would often happen is you'd get two newspapers with opposing headlines coming out of the same hearing.
I succeeded.
I'm amused by the difference between what actually takes place in the meetings and what some are trying to, you know, say takes place. It's quite comical, actually, when you realize the difference between reality and what some people are talking on TV about. If you've been in politics as long as I am, you get used to that kind of technique.
Now, if there's a smile on my face, it's only there trying to fool the public. But when it comes down to fooling you, now, honey, that's quite a different subject.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is October 23rd, and this episode begins our series on the Trivium. Now, I may or may not have mentioned this before, but I am not a religious man. And many people have written to me in the past about the discussion of the Trivium in prior shows to warn me of its religious history, and I'm well aware of that, how the Trivium and where the Trivium has been used. Ultimately, on School Sucks Podcast, we will make some distinctions between the classical Trivium, which has largely been used to confuse or manipulate, and the Trivium method, which is really a useful set of tools for learning anything you want. The three primary questions that this series will aim to answer: number one, what is the Trivium method? Number two, why should we learn this, whether we're autodidacts or home educators? And three, how can we make this method useful in our everyday lives? So, in light of some of the concerns that have been expressed in the past to me about the Trivium, this series will not aim in any way to memorialize some kind of religious practice. Ironically, though, I'd like to start the show today with a quote from a man named Jesus, who supposedly once said, "If you give a man a fish, he can eat for a day. But if you teach a man to fish, he'll eat, you know, beyond that day, because now he knows how to fish." That's a paraphrase of the quote. But that's a powerful thought when we relate it to our understanding of how institutionalized schooling has worked for so long in this country and around the world. People sit passively in desks where an expert presents his or herself in front of the classroom and then gives them the knowledge of a subject. But through this process, one thing that is certainly not taught is a kind of intellectual independence, learning how to learn for oneself. Now, many of you are already familiar with the Trivium method, But for those who are completely uninitiated, I wanted to include right up front here just a few paragraphs from a Tragedy and Hope outline on the Trivium that I will include embedded in the show notes as a scribed document. We are now witnessing the accumulating negative effects of omitting the three means of learning how to learn, which constitute the integrated classical trivium, the first three of the seven liberal arts and sciences. The last four constituents are called the quadrivium. So that's where the seven liberal arts come from. The first three are the trivium, the next four are the quadrivium. In a classical primary and secondary education curriculum, the components of the trivium, general grammar, formal Aristotelian logic, and classical rhetoric, are presented to students to train them in learning how to learn, and concurrently, in validly thinking systematically. The trivium is presented to methodically gather raw, factual data into a coherent body of knowledge, grammar, then to gain understanding of that body by systematically eliminating all stated contradictions within it, dialectic or logic, and finally, to wisely express and utilize that valid knowledge and understanding in the objective real world, rhetoric. Once a student is conversant with this threefold procedural pattern, he is now capable, and this is one of the great values of the trivium, of teaching himself, with minimal guidance from an instructor or facilitator, how to learn any established subject, such as mathematics, geometry, musical theory, astronomy, physics, chemistry, history, philosophy, etc., or of fully grasping any propositional topic he is motivated upon which to focus, like current socio-political issues, newly developing scientific hypotheses, historical and literary analyses, and so forth. In other words, through the process of learning how to learn, he learns how to critically and creatively think for himself. That last sentence sums up the process. But I wanted to start the show today by reading a piece by the English poet and playwright Dorothy L. Sayers, and it is called The Lost Tools of Learning. This essay was first published in 1947, and it is somewhat lengthy, so I'm going to skip around a little bit and skip past some things that I think are non-essential, and I will also include other parts of this essay in later installments in this series. If you're already very familiar with this essay and you want to skip ahead a little bit, my conversation with Gene begins roughly 28 minutes from right now. So here we go. That I, whose experience of teaching is extremely limited, should presume to discuss education is a matter surely that calls for no apology. It is a kind of behavior to which the present climate of opinion is wholly favorable. Bishops air their opinions about economics, biologists about metaphysics, inorganic chemists about theology. The most irrelevant people are appointed to highly technical ministries, and plain blunt men write to the papers to say that Epstein and Picasso do not know how to draw. Up to a certain point, and provided the criticisms are made with a reasonable modesty, these activities are commendable. Too much specialization is not a good thing. There's also one excellent reason why the veriest amateur may feel entitled to have an opinion about education. For if we are not all professional teachers, we have all, at some time or another, been taught. Even if we learnt nothing, perhaps in particular if we learnt nothing, our contribution to the discussion may have a potential value. However, it is in the highest degree improbable that the reforms I propose will ever be carried into effect. Neither the parents, nor the training colleges, nor the examination boards, nor the boards of governors, nor the ministries of education would countenance them for a moment. For they amount to this, that if we are to produce a society of educated people, fitted to preserve their intellectual freedom amid the complex pressures of our modern society, we must turn back the wheel of progress some 400 or 500 years, to the point at which education began to lose sight of its true object, toward the end of the Middle Ages. Before you dismiss me with the appropriate phrase, reactionary, romantic, medievalist, laudator temporis acti, praiser of times past, or whatever tag comes first to hand, I will ask you to consider one or two miscellaneous questions that hang about at the back, perhaps, of all of our minds, and occasionally pop out to worry us. When we think about the remarkably early age at which young men went up to university in, let us say, Tudor times, and thereafter were held fit to assume responsibility for the conduct of their own affairs, are we altogether comfortable about the artificial prolongation of intellectual childhood and adolescence into the years of physical maturity, which is so marked in our own day? To postpone the acceptance of responsibility to a late date brings with it a number of psychological complications which, while they may interest the psychiatrist, are scarcely beneficial to either the individual or to society. The stock argument in favor of postponing the school leaving age and prolonging the period of education generally is there is now so much more to learn than there was in the Middle Ages. This is partly true, but not wholly. The modern boy and girl are certainly taught more subjects, but does that always mean they actually know more? Has it ever struck you as odd or unfortunate that today, when the proportion of literacy throughout Western Europe is higher than it has ever been, people should have become susceptible to the influence of advertisement and mass propaganda to an extent hitherto unheard of and unimagined? Do you put this down to the mere mechanical fact that the press and the radio and so on have made propaganda much easier to distribute over a wide area? Or do you sometimes have an uneasy suspicion that the product of modern educational methods is less good than he or she might be at disentangling fact from fiction and the proven from the plausible? Have you ever, in listening to a debate among adult and presumably responsible people, been fretted by the extraordinary inability of the average debater to speak to the question or to meet and refute the arguments of speakers on the other side? Have you ever pondered upon the extremely high incidence of irrelevant matter which crops up at committee meetings and upon the very great rarity of persons capable of acting as chairman of committees? And when you think of this, and think that most of our public affairs are settled by debates and committees, have you ever felt a certain sinking of the heart? Have you ever followed a discussion in the newspapers or elsewhere and noticed how frequently writers fail to define the terms they use? Or how often, if one man does define his terms, another will assume in his reply that he was using terms in precisely the opposite sense to that in which he has already defined them? Have you ever been faintly troubled by the amount of slipshod syntax going about? And if so, are you troubled because it is inelegant or because it may lead to dangerous misunderstanding? Do you ever find that young people, when they have left school, not only forget most of what they've learned, but forget also or betray that they have never really known how to tackle a new subject for themselves? Are you often bothered by coming across grown-up men and women who seem unable to distinguish between a book that is sound, scholarly, and properly documented, and one that is, to any trained eye, very conspicuously, none of these things? Or someone who cannot handle a library catalog, or who, when faced with a book of reference, betray a curious inability to extract from it the passages relevant to the particular question which interests them? Do you often come across people for whom all of their lives a subject remains a subject, divided by watertight bulkheads from all other subjects, so that they experience very great difficulty in making an immediate mental connection between, let us say, algebra and detective fiction, sewage disposal and the price of salmon, or more generally, between such spheres of knowledge as philosophy and economics, or chemistry and art? Are you occasionally perturbed by the things written by adult men and women for adult men and women to read? Now, in the few paragraphs that follow, Sayers goes on to give some specifics to better illustrate these questions that she has asked us so far. But we're going to skip ahead a little bit. Because if you've been listening to this show for a while, you are probably already familiar with what the answers to those questions might look like. So, a few short paragraphs later, she goes on to ask, is not the great defect of our education today, a defect traceable through all the disquieting symptoms of trouble that I have mentioned, that although we often succeed in teaching our pupils subjects, we fail lamentably on the whole in teaching them how to think. They learn everything except the art of learning. It is as though we had taught a child, mechanically, and by rule of thumb, to play the harmonious blacksmith upon the piano, but had never taught him the scale or how to read music. So that, having memorized the harmonious blacksmith, he still had not the faintest notion of how to proceed from that to tackle the last rose of summer. In certain of the arts and crafts, we sometimes do precisely this, requiring a child to express himself in paint before we teach him how to handle the colors and the brush. There is a school of thought which believes this to be the right way to set about the job, but observe, it is not the way in which a trained craftsman will go about to teach himself a new medium. He, having learned by experience the best way to economize labor and take the thing by the right end, will start off by doodling about on an odd piece of material in order to give himself the feel of the tool. Let us now look at the medieval scheme of education, the syllabus of the schools. It does not matter for the moment whether it was devised for small children or for older students, or how long people were supposed to take over it. What matters is the light it throws upon what the men of the Middle Ages supposed to be the object and the right order of the educative process. The syllabus was divided into two parts, the trivium and the quadrivium. The second part, the quadrivium, consisted of subjects and need not for the moment concern us. The interesting thing for us is the composition of the trivium, which preceded the quadrivium and was the preliminary discipline for it. It consisted of three parts, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, in that order. Now, the first thing we notice is that two, at any rate, of these subjects are not what we should call subjects at all. They are only methods of dealing with subjects. Grammar, indeed, is a subject in the sense that it does mean definitely learning a language. At that period, it meant learning Latin. But language itself is simply the medium in which thought is expressed. The whole of the trivium was, in fact, intended to teach the pupil the proper use of the tools of learning before he began to apply them to subjects at all. First, he learned a language, not just how to order a meal in a foreign language, but the structure of the language, and hence of the language itself, what it was, how it was put together, and how it worked. Secondly, he learned how to use the language, how to define its terms, and make accurate statements, how to construct an argument, and how to detect fallacies in the argument. Dialectic, that is to say, embraced logic and disputation. Thirdly, he learned to express himself in language, how to say what he had to say elegantly and persuasively. At the end of his course, he was required to compose a thesis upon some theme set by his masters or chosen by himself, and afterwards to defend his thesis against the criticism of the faculty. By this time, he would have learned not merely to write an essay on paper, but to speak audibly and intelligibly from a platform, and to use his wits quickly when heckled. There would also be questions, cogent and shrewd, from those who had already run the gauntlet of debate. It is, of course, quite true that bits and pieces of the medieval tradition still linger or have been revived in the ordinary school syllabus of today. Some knowledge of grammar is still required when learning a foreign language. Perhaps I should say, is again required. For during my own lifetime, we passed through a phase when the teaching of declensions and conjugations was considered rather reprehensible, and it was considered better to pick these things up as we went along. School debating societies flourish, essays are written, the necessity for self-expression is stressed, and perhaps even overstressed. But these activities are cultivated more or less in detachment, as belonging to the special subjects in which they are pigeonholed, rather than as forming one coherent scheme of mental training to which all subjects stand in a subordinate relation. Grammar belongs especially to the subject of foreign languages, and essay writing to the subject called English, while dialectic has become almost entirely divorced from the rest of the curriculum and is frequently practiced unsystematically and out of school hours as a separate exercise, only very loosely related to the main business of learning. Taken by and large, the great difference of emphasis between the two conceptions holds good. Modern education concentrates on teaching subjects, leaving the method of thinking, arguing, and expressing one's conclusions to be picked up by the scholar as he goes along. Medieval education concentrated on first forging and learning to handle the tools of learning, using whatever subject came handy as a piece of material on which to doodle, until the use of the tool became second nature. The next few paragraphs hint at some modern criticisms of the trivium for being too methodical and deliberate, but Sayers goes on to stress the intellectual self-defense that this provided for the learners, some of the learners at that time. I know that when we're talking about medieval times, you're like, wait, nobody learned anything then. Some people did. Some people did. A few paragraphs later, she continues on that vein, "For we let our young men and women go out unarmed, in a day when armor was never so necessary. By teaching them all to read, we have left them at the mercy of the printed word. By the invention of film and radio, we have made certain that no aversion to reading shall secure them from the incessant battery of words, words, words. They do not know what the words mean. They do not know how to ward them off or blunt their edge or fling them back. They are a prey to words in their emotions instead of being masters of them in their intellects. We who were scandalized in 1940 when men were sent to fight armored tanks with rifles are not scandalized when men and women are sent into the world to fight mass propaganda with a smattering of subjects, and when whole classes and whole nations become hypnotized by the arts of the spellbinder, we have the impudence to be astonished. We dole out lip service to the importance of education, lip service, and just occasionally a little grant of money. We postpone the school leaving age and plan to build bigger and better schools. The teachers slave conscientiously in and out of school hours, and yet, as I believe, all this devoted effort is largely frustrated, because we have lost the tools of learning, and in their absence can only make a botched and piecemeal job of it." Now, in the next few paragraphs, she goes on to outline a plan for implementation. I'm going to skip through that. We don't like plans for implementation as far as some kind of mass schooling system is concerned. Also, it's worth pointing out that this was written in 1947, so some of what she suggests might be antiquated or entirely irrelevant considering the technological advantages we have today. But because I want this show obviously to be useful to home educators, I thought this next paragraph was interesting, at least for maybe providing a map. And after I read it, we're going to move into her discussion of grammar, which is also somewhat prescriptive, but I'm hoping it will provide, again, some valuable details. But of course, for our purposes, I do not intend the inclusion of this to be interpreted as prescriptive, like this is what should be going on. Those are questions that I have fielded from time to time. I'm a home educating parent. I have a child who's this many years old. What should be happening? You know, it's hard for me to deal with shoulds. So I hope that this will just be entered into the record here as suggestions, and also maybe for providing a better map or a better outline for people who are trying to learn the trivium method for themselves, adults. She writes, "My views about child psychology are, I admit, neither orthodox nor enlightened. Looking back upon myself, since I am the child I know best and the only child I can pretend to know from inside, I recognize three states of development. These, in a rough and ready fashion, I will call the poll parrot, the pert, and the poetic, the latter coinciding approximately with the onset of puberty. The poll parrot stage is one in which learning by heart is easy and on the whole pleasurable, whereas nothing is difficult and on the whole little relished. At this age, one readily memorizes the shapes and appearances of things. One likes to recite the number plates of cars. One rejoices in the chanting of rhymes and the rumble and thunder of unintelligible polysyllables. One enjoys the mere accumulation of things. The pert age, which follows upon this and naturally overlaps it to some extent, is characterized by contradicting, answering back, liking to catch people out, especially one's elders. And just to interject, if you are unfamiliar with that phrase, catch people out, it basically means calling people on their BS in a way that they will not find as adorable once you are an adult. Liking to catch people out, especially one's elders, and by the propounding of conundrums. Its nuisance value is extremely high. It usually sets in about the fourth form. I'm guessing that's age four. The poetic age is popularly known as the difficult age. It is self-centered. It yearns to express itself. It rather specializes in being misunderstood. It is restless and tries to achieve independence. And with good luck and good guidance, it should show the beginnings of creativeness, a reaching out toward a synthesis of what it already knows, and a deliberate eagerness to know and to do some one thing in preference to all others. Now, it seems to me that the layout of the trivium adapts itself with a singular appropriateness to these three ages: grammar to the poll parrot, dialectic to the pert, and rhetoric to the poetic age. So now we go into a specific discussion of grammar. And hopefully this will help some of you who might be relatively unfamiliar with the trivium gain a better understanding of what general grammar is all about. But I'll just include one more note of preparation for what I'm about to read, so this doesn't come across as intimidating or off-putting. Sayers does use a lot of shoulds, and I will start here. I will say at once, quite firmly, that the best grounding for education is the Latin grammar. I say this not because Latin is traditional and medieval, but simply because even a rudimentary knowledge of Latin cuts down the labor and pains of learning almost any other subject by at least 50%. It is the key to the vocabulary and structure of all the Teutonic languages, as well as to the technical vocabulary of all the sciences and to the literature of the entire Mediterranean civilization, together with all its historical documents. Those whose pedantic preference for a living language persuades them to deprive their pupils of all these advantages might substitute Russian, whose grammar is still more primitive. Russian is, of course, helpful with the other Slav dialects. There is something also to be said for classical Greek. But my own choice is Latin. Having thus pleased the classicists among you, I will proceed to horrify them by adding that I do not think it either wise or necessary to cramp the ordinary pupil upon the Procrustean bed of the Augustan age, with its highly elaborate and artificial verse forms and oratory. Post-classical and medieval Latin, which was a living language right down to the end of the Renaissance, is easier and in some ways livelier. A study of it helps to dispel the widespread notion that learning and literature came to a full stop when Christ was born and only woke up again with the dissolution of the monasteries. Latin should be begun as early as possible, at a time when inflicted speech seems no more astonishing than any other phenomenon in an astonishing world, and when the chanting Amo, Amos, Amat is as ritually agreeable to the feelings as the chanting of Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo. During this age, we must, of course, exercise the mind on other things besides Latin grammar. Observation and memory are the faculties most lively at this period, and if we are to learn a contemporary foreign language, we should begin now, before the facial and mental muscles become rebellious to strange intonations. Spoken French and German can be practiced alongside the grammatical discipline of Latin. In English, meanwhile, verse and prose can be learned by heart, and the pupil's memory should be stored with stories of every kind, classical myth, European legend, and so forth. I do not think that the classical stories and masterpieces of ancient literature should be made the vile bodies on which to practice the techniques of grammar. That was a fault of medieval education, which we not need perpetuate. The stories can be enjoyed and remembered in English, and related to their origin at a subsequent stage. Recitation aloud should be practiced, individually or in chorus, for we must not forget that we are laying the groundwork for disputation and rhetoric. The grammar of history should consist, I think, of dates, events, anecdotes, and personalities. A set of dates to which one can peg all later historical knowledge is of enormous help later on in establishing the perspective of history. It does not greatly matter which dates, those of the kings of England will do very nicely, provided that they are accompanied by pictures of costumes, architecture, and other everyday things, so that the mere mention of a date calls up a very strong visual presentment of the whole period. Geography will similarly be presented in its factual aspect, with maps, natural features, and visible presentment of customs, costumes, flora, fauna, and so on. And I believe myself that the discredited and old-fashioned memorizing of a few capital cities, rivers, mountain ranges, etc. does no harm. Stamp collecting may be encouraged. From my own experience, I have to ask here, when was the rote memorization of state capitals discredited? We were doing that in the 80s and 90s, maybe even in college. Science, in the Pole-Parrot period, arranges itself naturally and easily around collections, the identifying and naming of specimens, and, in general, the kind of thing that used to be called natural philosophy. To know the name and property of things is, at this age, a satisfaction in itself. To recognize a devil's coach horse at sight and assure one's foolish elders that, in spite of its appearance, it does not sting, to be able to pick out Cassiopeia and the Pylades, and perhaps even to know who Cassiopeia and the Pylades were, to be aware that a whale is not a fish, and a bat not a bird, all of these things give a pleasant sensation of superiority, while to know a ring snake from an adder or a poisonous from an edible toadstool is a kind of knowledge that also has practical value. The grammar of mathematics begins, of course, with the multiplication table, which, if not learnt now, will never be learnt with pleasure, and with the recognition of geometrical shapes and the grouping of numbers. These exercises lead naturally to the doing of simple sums in arithmetic. More complicated mathematical processes may, and perhaps should, be postponed for reasons which will presently appear. So far, except, of course, for the Latin, our curriculum contains nothing that departs very far from common practice. The difference will be felt rather in the attitude of the teachers, who must look upon these activities less as subjects in themselves than as a gathering together of material for use in the next part of the trivium. And, of course, let's include self-teachers in that. What that material is only of secondary importance. But it is as well that anything and everything which can be usefully committed to memory should be memorized at this period, whether it is immediately intelligible or not. The modern tendency is to try and force rational explanations on a child's mind at too early an age. Intelligent questions, spontaneously asked, should, of course, receive an immediate and rational answer. But it is a great mistake to suppose that a child cannot readily enjoy and remember things that are beyond his power to analyze, particularly if those things have a strong imaginative appeal, an attractive jingle, or an abundance of rich, resounding polysyllables. The next paragraph deals with theology. If you're interested in that, I'll put a link to this whole piece in the show notes. And the paragraph immediately after that begins, "It is difficult to say at what age, precisely, we should pass from the first to the second part of the trivium. Generally speaking, the answer is, so soon as the child shows himself disposed to pertness and interminable argument. For as, in the first part, the master faculties are observation and memory, so in the second, the master faculty is the discursive reason. In the first, the exercise to which the rest of the material was, as it were, keyed, was the Latin grammar. In the second, the key exercise will be formal logic. It is here that our curriculum shows its first sharp divergence from modern standards. The disrepute into which formal logic has fallen is entirely unjustified, and its neglect is the root cause of nearly all those disquieting symptoms which we have noted in the modern intellectual constitution. Logic has been discredited partly because we have come to suppose that we are conditioned almost entirely by the intuitive and the unconscious. There is no time to argue whether this is true. I will simply observe that to neglect the proper training of the reason is the best possible way to make it true. So from here, the discussion moves into the logic of the trivium, and I will include that portion of The Lost Tools of Learning at the beginning of the next installment in this series. I hope you've found what we've included so far to be useful, or at least thought-provoking, and as always, I look forward to your feedback. Here's my first of three conversations with Gene Denning. Gene, so good to finally have you on the show. Certainly long overdue.
Well, Brett, thank you for having me. I've been a longtime fan ever since you started up, I believe, in 2009.
Yeah.
I was particularly attracted to the introduction to each show. You always had a critical thinking question, which led into the topics that were covered for that particular show. And that's what attracted me.
Yeah. Those were the ones in the math book that we never had to do. We always got to skip those as long as we had done, you know, numbers 1 through 35 odd, basically the same process over and over and over again. Not that repetition doesn't have its place, but we never really got an opportunity to flex those critical thinking muscles in school from my experience. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was important to reintroduce that idea to the audience. And that's why, of course, you're here today, because we're going to talk about the big picture of critical thinking. And first, you know, my audience is already familiar. They know the name. And if people have listened to Gnostic Media or The Unplugged Mom, they might have even heard discussions with you from the past. But I thought I would just give you an opportunity up front here to give us a little bit of information about your background.
Okay, well, I think it was somewhat significant as to where I was born and raised, which was Las Cruces, New Mexico. And at the time, it was a mid-sized town, I'd say. And that played into a lot of the input that I got from the adults around me, I believe, because it was a farming community, large families, so on and so forth. I started to get a lot of my information as to how to conduct life, how to think clearly as you go through life, from family members at first. A couple of uncles helped me along this path. When I was 8, 9 years old, I had a set of books. There were 12 volumes. And what they had were the classical stories from the Western canon, essentially. A lot of the standard nursery rhymes, but also, as I say, the classics that were written for children. And I had these read to me from the time that I can remember, from the age 3 and 4, up until I became a good reader, which was a little bit later in my case than most people. But this idea of having these books read to me over and over started to lead me into this notion that we can clearly and deliberately think our way through life. So I started with that, and then by the time my mother helped me out learning how to read when I was 9 years old, using the technique that she was taught, which was phonics. And she was taught this in public school in the 1920s. And then they went to the whole word method of teaching, which I believe Alexander Graham Bell's father was involved in bringing this method of whole word into play, because he was teaching deaf children how to read. And of course, he couldn't use phonics. So he used the Oriental method, especially the Chinese, of looking at abstract symbols and memorizing
sure.
them and coming back with the word. And so I didn't get to memorize all these things in my early years in public school because I had all the childhood diseases. And by the time I was 9, there was a teacher who recognized that I couldn't read, brought my mother in for a conference, and my mother says, "I'll take care of it." So she taught me the phonetic method of reading at that time. And later on, she taught me the basics of what we're going to be discussing today, which is bringing me into the taking grammar out of the abstract world into the real world. And that's where things started to make sense to me.
I often think about that, just to go back to what you said about the look-say versus the phonetic method of learning to read. You know, these progressives, these John Dewey types, they couldn't have really been that nefarious in their intentions, I don't think. They're the targets of certainly a lot of criticism, but you could see how maybe the look-say method has some value for identification purposes for certain types of words. I've certainly been very critical of it throughout the entire history of the show. But the way you just said that there, I mean, obviously English is a phonetic language where you have phonemes and written as graphemes and you put them together to, you know, make a whole word. But the symbol-based languages or learning through symbols or being able to identify things in your environment can, I would think, for a young reader, maybe build some confidence, maybe help them get a little bit of a running start, but it really doesn't teach you to be a strong and complete reader as an adult.
Well, when you're using a phonetic system, yeah. Again, I'm going to be, you'll probably hear me say this repeatedly. Rather than either or, the idea might be also and.
Indeed.
So I think the idea in English or in the Western languages, which are symbolized by the phonetic alphabet, we can start with that. And then later on, as you start to get into speed reading techniques and so forth, you can look at the entire symbol or even an entire sentence or paragraph and start to bring things out of it. And that is, as you say, the look-see method. So I don't know that we want to start necessarily with the look-see or the whole word, but this is where I started to notice that there was a disconnect between school and the parent. Because my parent, my mother, my father was taught whole word. He went to school in Philadelphia. So he had all the so-called progressive training, being in a cultural and political center. And there was my mother off in the backwoods of southern New Mexico being taught these old-fashioned techniques of learning. So I was able to compare and contrast there as well. But where it really came into play, and you can see it's showing up today in testing among developed countries, the United States student is now well below the midway point in mathematics. And what I started to notice after being aware of this difference at a very early age between phonics and whole word, what I started to notice is that the computation that was being provided for arithmetic and mathematics were changing every few years. Therefore, the student couldn't go home and consult his parent as to how to do his math problems. And you're seeing that just constantly nowadays. The computation methods are being continually changed so that an older sibling can no longer help his younger sibling in mathematical computation problems, and certainly not the parent.
Yeah, I caught my tongue one time when I was tutoring a middle schooler and he was learning multiplication. And, you know, this was a few years ago, but I was in middle school 15 years prior to this incident. And he was showing me something called the lattice method, I think it was called. And it was like this giant grid system. And I said out loud to this 13-year-old, "This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen." I was like, "You wait a minute. Just can't you just do it like this?" And I wrote the numbers over each other and, tried to give him some of the strategies that had been helpful for me in learning multiplication. And I was surprised that he was relatively unfamiliar with this. I worked with high school kids who don't know what remainders are. Because right. They've never done long division. So, that's an interesting point that you can't, an older generation can't be a check against the deteriorating quality of schooling.
Well, it all goes back to this divide and conquer strategy that seems to be prevalent in the world and probably has been for a long time. It just happens to be, you can see it in this story I just told about reading, but you can really see it today in mathematics. And one of the ways that people might be able to get around this is, as is often the case to solve a problem, is to look to your own resources rather than going necessarily to the prevalent authority of the time. And one of the places that I started to get some insight into the various ways of computing numbers is called Vedic mathematics. Yep. And you can go online, and there are a number of sources there. And you don't necessarily have to learn the techniques. Just become aware that all these techniques are out there. And if you can settle, this is what's so great about home education, is you can now get on the same page with the techniques, the detailed techniques that your parent was taught and told. And this only bolsters the family unit when you can communicate on that level. So I've become just a tremendous fan of home education. And now I'm seeing that there's a lot of emphasis on what's being called alternative education or even core education, which is that you can attend public school, but you get a core education at home. I just attended a conference this past weekend, Parents for Liberty, with some people that you've been in contact with, Justin sure. and Jessica Armand.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there were a number of people in there that had classical schools, private classical schools that were going, home educators, people interested in this, newly pregnant women who want to be sure that their children are going to get off on the right foot in their education that we're attending here. It was quite a spectrum of people that were concerned with learning how to learn and think to live effectively. Mm,
yeah, and a new generation of young children that can actually find out what liberal arts means, you know, or liberal, what yes. the liberal arts yeah. are. You know, I certainly had heard that term thrown around through my teen years and even into my 20s without ever knowing what it meant. I mean, you know, I knew that if you wanted to go to college, but you didn't know what you wanted to do in life, you could major in liberal arts. I went to graduate school at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. But like most things that we hear, if we're not trained to, you know, be consciously interfacing with the world around us, I'd never really gave it another thought as far as what liberal arts meant. Sounded nice, but I realized that, well, nobody involved in this process that we call education is really familiar with this because they're not being taught it at all. So why do you think that is? Just a history question going back from this current generation to several generations into the past. I mean, this can actually take us a long way back into the past. Why don't we know, most people anyway, what the liberal arts are?
Well, you're right. You do have to go back in history. And one point that we can go is to the classical period of Greece and Rome. From around 500 BC up until the first century, but they had a class system set up in the Greek city-states. And there was the upper echelon, which were the educated people, and these were the citizens. They were given the liberal arts, and I think many of the various city-states provided this through the parent. And then we get up to the time of Plato, and then he starts taking people that had already been taught the liberal arts, of which there are seven, the trivium and the quadrivium. Now, the trivium was taught from the time of childhood. You're given the tools to learn, which is grammar, words. Words are the tools of grammar. So you devise a lexicon. You devise a lexicon first to communicate, and then, of course, to think. So you use your lexicon for this ability that humans have of thinking in conceptual terms by modeling the world rather than actually having to live out experience a process. You can model an experience with your conceptual thought faculty.
Right.
So the way to do that is to use these tools. And then by the time they reach puberty, you could start to get them to understand what they had already learned, because that doesn't necessarily come with data. What you're given and what you're suited for from about age 3 until 10 or 11 is just your prepubescent years is this idea that you can absorb data at a tremendous rate. And that's why children have such a facility with multiple languages. facts, stories, fantasies. And then when they get into this questioning period in their pubescent years, when they start to ask questions, a lot of people think that they're just asking questions of their parents or the people around them, but they're actually starting to ask questions of themselves. And what they're trying to do is take this data and understand it. Well, what is understanding? It means that when you think through a complete thought, something that, that you're talking about and something that's being said about it, what we now call the subject and the predicate, that is a complete thought. So when you think of a complete thought, the way you got the data as a child or ongoing, the way you got the data was in a particular sequence. Now, there may not have been any contradiction within the data, but your interpretation of that data has contradictions. So understanding is really just taking the contradictions out of a proposition or a number of complete thoughts. Go back through there. Go back through your grammar, the way it's structured in sentences, paragraphs, and treatises, or monographs, if you want to call it that. That would be the simplest way of expressing a complex subject or topic as a monograph. So you go back through there, and to understand is to take either the contradictions that you're holding or the contradictions that were given to you. And you have you now have a critical mass of information that makes sense because everything follows. And it follows because there are no contradictions within that monograph, let's say.
And when you reach that age, what we have come to call adolescence, you certainly have quite an inventory of contradictions, of things that you've been told as a young child. And when we're talking about the grammar, there's also things that are unquestionable. You know, every piece of grammar also, and we'll get into this in more detail, but also has a metagrammar. You can kind of take it apart even further and drill down to even smaller components. It kind of relates to the question I asked about the history of the obscuring of the liberal arts. It seemed like, you know, you mentioned Rome. Out of Rome, after the collapse of Rome, you know, that region was certainly taken over by the church, and they, at least ostensibly, embraced this liberal arts education. But they were kind of using it to seek a scientific justification for religious beliefs. So there was a grammar, as far as I've come to understand it anyway, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was prepackaged, that couldn't be questioned, that couldn't be taken apart, that couldn't be drilled down or separated further into components. So, you know, I think our history reflects that, that there's a lot of things that have just kind of been passed through time and taken for granted or taken as is or not properly examined. A young child has that same experience by the time they reach adolescence. They have a lot of things that they realize they can start looking at more closely. And the more closely they examine those things, the more contradictions become apparent.
Yes, especially if you have, as I say, that critical mass of instruction. Now, back in Greece and Rome, before the church became prevalent, the upper classes, the patricians, were given this instruction essentially at home, and the idea was to free your mind. In order to think propositions all the way through, to have a view of the big picture. So these were the citizens. Now, the people, and as I mentioned, you come to realize this big picture. And also, by the way, you come to trust your own thought process. You come to respect yourself by having this background. Now, the seven liberal arts were given to these citizens to free their mind. And just a quick aside, because liberal means to free or to liberate, the idea that in more modern times that a person of a political persuasion who's called a liberal means that it's unstructured or it's free or there are no ethics to be had from a liberal person. And it's just between the use, the connotation of the word free. Now, liberal originally meant to free your mind from superstition, from prejudice. In other words, to see the world as it is clearly, to free your mind to see that, to get rid of that prejudicial viewpoint, to do away with superstition. And the people that weren't trained in the seven liberal arts, particularly the trivium, or how to learn and how to think accurately and properly, went into the seven mechanical or the servile arts. And these were the people that were apprenticed. You learned with a master to do something essentially with your hands. And there were seven of those as well. Tailoring and weaving was one of the mechanical arts. The second was agriculture. The third was architecture, really hands-on masonry, because architecture goes into another category. There was also the militia, which was warfare and hunting. These are the martial arts. Then there were the merchant arts of trade and commerce, and the cooking arts. And finally, the blacksmithing and metallurgy arts. And these were taught to the second tier level within the city-state and its surroundings, its agricultural surroundings, to deal with the construction and physical maintenance of the city-state. And finally, there were the fine arts, and there were seven of them: architecture, fine painting, sculpture, music, dance, drama, and poetry or literature. So they had this fixation on the number seven for some reason, but that was the way that the city-state was broken up.
And it's interesting, too, if I can just interject there, that you can see the potential for the development of a caste system, especially when you're talking about the servile arts or the illiberal arts, as we might call them, because of their specificity. I mean, the great thing about, the trivium or other tools that we can use to free our minds is that they're portable. If you understand the method of the trivium, if you know how to use that into every new or introduce that into every new experience or every uncomfortable situation or learning opportunity that you encounter, those tools are portable. But some of these other arts, the servile arts, they seem like they're more specific. Like you can't pick up from the militia and say, oh, well, I'll go use these skills to do something completely different. While the liberal arts, which again, liberal meaning free, does allow that mobility in thought and action.
Well, that's exactly right. The trivium in particular really reflects the way we naturally, in our childhood, observe and put questions into our minds, pick up that data for understanding in our adolescence and young adulthood. But you're right. If you over-specialize, and you can see that in our current culture, is we're becoming over-specialized. We don't have generalists who have been exposed to the liberating arts to look at the big picture. And this, several commentators have said, is one of the characteristics of late empire. Is you start to see over-specialization, and you also see, and this is getting a little out there right now, but you also see a lot of superficial concern with physical presentation or cosmetics. So cosmetics and over-specialization seems to be one of those, or a couple of the traits within the later stage of a martial culture, and we're seeing that today. But you're right. Once you're stuck into a mechanical or a servile art, you're dependent on the master to continue your advancement within that discipline, because you don't have the tools of learning how to learn.
Yeah.
Of observing, understanding, and utilizing.
And it's interesting, too, because, I mean, this is a process. Just as a professional who's maybe changed career paths a couple of times, you know, looking at my resume and going through this process, it's just because of the schooling that I've had, it almost feels unnatural. It almost feels like embellishing to be going through my resume and say, well, how can the skills that I have translate into this job that I want? Right? If there's something that seems like unnatural or dishonest about going through that process. But when you think about it in terms of the trivium, in terms of the liberal arts, it's actually kind of a natural and healthy process to say, okay, what skills have I picked up? Where else might they be useful?
Yeah. Now we get to the point, we'll go back to my story, because I'm right up to the point that I start my adolescence. And I actually was given this assignment in a social studies course to we all were, to seek out and interview someone in the field that we were interested in going into. And I was very much interested in craftsmanship by that time. I was, my hobby was making model airplanes and cars and so forth. So I had an aunt who was a dental assistant with my family dentist. And so I went to interview him. And this, by the way, is one of the precepts that John Taylor Gatto recommends, that you go out and start looking into the vocational area in which you might be interested. And oftentimes you'll find out that the reality of what you think you might be interested in is different than what you have in your mind. But I had no idea that I would be interested in dentistry, because to me, dentistry was pulling teeth and straightening teeth and this, that, and the other. So I went to my family dentist and he took me to the back room. And back there was the dental laboratory, and this is where all the crowns and the bridges and the dentures and the false teeth and the dental prosthetic work was done. Mm-hmm. And the way he presented it to me is, he says, this is a mini factory. He says, you'll learn metallurgy back here. You'll learn everything except the production line method of producing goods. And he had a look at my craftsmanship with model airplanes and so forth, and he could tell that I might be suited for this. So this is the way he started to present this to me. And once I was showing up every day after school. I was in middle school at the time, junior high as we called it back then. And I showed up every day after school, very handy for me, and loved it. So one of the things that he started to mention to me about 4 months into this is that he was going to put me into a preceptorship program. And he said, this is like an apprenticeship, but he says, this is a professional field like medicine, law, and ecclesiastical pursuits. Mm-hmm. And he says, this is what every community more or less needs. And this is the way these arts, these healing arts were taught before we had medical and dental schools in this country, is that you would actually go in with a practitioner, become essentially an apprentice. But he never specified this to me. But one of the things that we started to do at this four-month juncture was, he started having me copy the dictionary, just a desk dictionary. And I couldn't figure out at first what he was doing, but he said I had to learn the grammar of dentistry, which had its own lexicon. And so then I started to take after it a little bit more readily. But I didn't like just copying out of a dictionary. You know, I wanted to get the lexicon of the mechanics of dentistry. Mm-hmm. But he was very patient with me, and he started to teach me about the grammar of dentistry. And then I would have questions. And we were about 2 years into our program by now. And he says, okay, now we're starting to get into the understanding. I was age 15 by now. I started with this man when I was 13. And this is when he told me that this is what a preceptorship is. It's giving you a mechanical art, but also showing you how to become, in his terms, a researcher. In other words, how to use a specific method to advance the mechanical art of dentistry or the mechanical art of healthcare by using your mind to come up with new or different methods and techniques. So, in other words, I was being given the three, as he called them, the three methods of learning how to learn. Mm-hmm. And he never used the word trivium. He did use the seven liberal arts. At this time, he said the other liberal arts are the quadrivium, having to do with number symbols. What we're going to be working with are letter symbols, so that we can get the spoken and thinking with letter symbols in place. And this is the three liberal arts of letter. So it wasn't until I was age 33 and I was overseas, and I heard the term trivium in an essay by Dorothy L. Sayers. And I think that's become fairly well known now. And it's called The Lost Tools of Learning. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time I was exposed to that term, trivium and quadrivium. But these were the seven liberating arts or liberal arts that I was exposed to we really, I was really steeped in the trivium, not so much in the quadrivium, because of this connection to the mechanical arts of dentistry. This particular dentist that I was preceptor to was of Swiss descent, and he used a lot of the terminology and made reference to the Knights Templar, who after they, for people who don't know who the Knights Templar were, their mechanical art was warfare, essentially. And they came into existence right around the first millennia, and they were an order of the Catholic Church directly under the Pope. They set up trips for landed gentry to go down to the Holy Land, ostensibly. And they called themselves the Poor Knights Templar of Jerusalem. And one of the things that was said is they were going down there to find King Solomon's mind, or the treasure that King Solomon supposedly had down there. And they really wound up with the methods of banking
yep.
that the Arabs had brought over from the Orient. And this was the gold that the Knights Templars assembled through various banking practices. But they're the ones, evidently, that came up with this term of preceptorship. Now, I haven't found an independent source yet, other than what I was told by this dentist, that a preceptorship is firstly giving you the mechanical arts, and then secondly giving you the liberal arts so that you can advance whatever mechanical art you're in.
Sure.
So that's evidently, and again, I'm not sure of this, this is evidently the difference between an apprenticeship, which teaches strictly the mechanical arts, and a preceptorship, which evidently gives you the portable tools, as you mentioned, to take with you to not only advance whatever your mechanical art is, but to live a satisfying and purposeful life.
So when you talk about this process of copying things out of the dictionary, where in the overall procedure of the preceptorship do you plot that activity?
Well, going back to the piece that Dorothy Sayers wrote, she said she tried to use the trivium to divide childhood development up to the age of around 21. And she said grammar is for children between 3 and 10 or 11 or so. And see, I had never had this concept that it was broken up, that it was a way to divide the preparatory stage of life, which is under age 20, 21. So she says that children were suited for taking in the tools, taking in word data, undifferentiated data. And then secondly, logic was for, again, when you start your internal dialogue. Another word for logic is dialectic. And I think one of the reasons dialectic is suited here is that term logic has been used for so many other disciplines, computer logic, and there's just all kinds of logic out there. And all of them are valid in that what they're referring to is the process of inference that a person takes, that one thing follows from another, that it's all of a piece. But dialectic is really going to this internal conversation that you start having with yourself right at the entrance to puberty, and also of questioning the authorities around you, your parents, your church, your teachers, particularly if they haven't been knocked out of you in school, as you have throughout the term of your podcast so completely examined.
I think it's also, too, dealing with the preconceived notions or the training, the unexamined training that you might have had up to that point in your life as well. When you reach this stage and start doing this dialectic, this conversation, it reminds me of Gatto when he said, you know, I write to argue with myself, you know, to have that conversation with myself. So I think it's not just questioning the authority, but also the residual impact that the authorities and their training has had on the young mind.
Sure. What the authorities have instilled in you.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I say, I think I was fortunate because I started to question and also provide answers at that age between 13 and 15 of many, many authorities, and started to have the self-confidence to trust my own thought process. And I started to trust it above what I was given by authorities. In other words, I always started to question what was being given. This leads to an odd situation here. When you start to have self-confidence, you start to have empathy for other people. When you can come to the idea that you are going on a path of learning and of continuing to learn, and you see other people who are on that same path, you really do have empathy with that person. But above that, you see that other people have not been given the opportunity to have this instilled within them, particularly at the right time. And your relationships with people become not so much to denigrate their thought process, but to try to put yourself in their position.
Yeah.
And that's part of having self-esteem, having self-love, having self-confidence, being self-determined. Now, there's an awful lot of self in there. And when I was involved with some home educating people, when I went through this little exercise of using those various synonymous terms as I'm using them, they couldn't quite grasp why the self. Why aren't you thinking of others? And that is one of the things that is an odd product of becoming self-confident, is that you start to think in empathetic terms about others. If only other people could have this, because they're all capable of it. Again, back to John Taylor Gatto. I believe it was he who said, genius is as common as dirt.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing too is, like, you know, we really don't have much to offer other people if our own world is chaotic and cluttered.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, when you're mentioning critical thinking or having this method or making this method explicit, so whenever you're something that's potentially uncomfortable or overwhelming comes into our environment and then into our minds, we have a way, we have that confidence, and we have a system of capture and integration that frees us in a way where we can be useful to other people.
Mm-hmm. A lot of what I've seen in John Gatto's work, I followed through the writings of Buckminster Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote what I consider his best book is called Critical Path. But there's also a very good biography called Buckminster Fuller's Universe, written by Stephen Seiden. And by reading Seiden's book, I finally understood what Fuller was trying to explain when he said that his thought was leading to answers that were 90 degrees out of phase with the question. And I couldn't quite put my finger on that. And I came across an esoteric term by Gurdjieff, Georg or George Gurdjieff. And he calls it logomenism, I believe is the term that he used. Now, this isn't a standard term, but you can look it up on the internet and get this idea of logomenism. And it's that you're taught a particular topic or a particular subject, and it relates to something that seems totally unrelated to it. Mm-hmm. And so what I found about the trivium, because it reflects our mental process of our conceptual mental process of learning and thinking, is that it applies essentially to everything. Jarrett Sanchez, I don't know that he's been on your show, has he?
Not yet.
You're familiar with him, yeah.
Yes, I am, yep. The Trivium Binder, I believe, is his project.
He has the Trivium Binder project. And he got this very early on, that you can use this method, essentially, to learn anything. You can learn how to play the game of checkers by observing, taking the contradictions out, and then doing it. But you can also learn astrophysics. It'll take you longer. But that's essentially what you're doing, is you're using this method over and over and over again. And it's a spiraling. It has a spiral structure to it, in that you get some grammar, you come to understand it, then you test yourself by writing, as Gatto said, to find out what you know, or telling someone else what you know, putting into a speech. And you may find out, no, you don't have enough data in here yet. So you spiral back down to the grammar, gather more data, take the contradictions out of it in the logical step, then write some more to see what you, and so on and so forth, until you have the discipline of astrophysics in place. So it's these cycles that keep using this technique or this method cyclically like that. And very quickly, it becomes, using computer parlance, running in the background. It's automatic. And the more you practice it, the more clear various things become to you. Life situations, not just subjects of study, topics, but just life situations become more and more clear to you. And the thing is, a lot of people say that that this seems a little bit cold, especially the part with logic, that it's so dry. And it may be, but this is the part of life that is presented to you, along with the emotional part and the intuitive part. So I'm going back to this. No, don't use the trivium as an alternative, but also as an addition to your emotional and your intuitive life, because this is the one you can control the most. This is the one you can make the most headway. Try to make headway with your emotional life to the degree that you can with your intellectual life. And many people spend, you know, their adult life in therapy, in psychological therapy, to try to get a handle on their emotions.
The interconnectivity between the two, the intellectual life and the emotional life, I mean, just from my own experience, it's so much more significant than I think a lot of people believe. And I realized that a lot of the personal struggles that I had, or the interpersonal conflict, or the emotional troubles, really boiled down to not having methods in place for dealing with difficult situations. So the methods were, obtained through an intellectual pursuit. And, you know, just like I mentioned before, you're not extremely useful to other people in any kind of way, in any kind of emotionally supportive role or friendship role or a romantic relationship, if your own internal thought process and internal dialogue is completely chaotic. And I know a lot of students have told me about this experience, and it's certainly an experience that I remember having as a college student and a high school student, listening to a lecture or reading something and coming across that one piece of grammar that we could trip over, you know, and no matter what happened after that, it wouldn't make sense. It would be Charlie Brown's teacher talking, you know, just be muffled and incoherent, because we encountered, you know, a term, a vocabulary word, a piece of grammar that we didn't understand, and that tripped us up, and we couldn't move on, and things got very chaotic. So recently, I've been working with Richard Grove of Tragedy and Hope in what I would half jokingly call kind of an apprenticeship internship, because I'm learning a lot of really valuable things. And we're getting ready to go down to Yale tomorrow to he's doing this video project. He's filming a presentation by Mark Passio, and I'm hoping to assist him however I can, but I'm completely unfamiliar with many aspects of the process. So we went through his equipment yesterday, and I just sat there with a notebook, and he would pick something up and show it to me, and I would write down what it is. Nothing more, right? But we understand that when somebody throws four or five pieces of new information at us, it can kind of almost feel irritating, you know?
Yeah.
Just like that, when you stumble across that uncomfortable or unfamiliar vocabulary word, and then nothing can make sense after that. So most people just get frustrated. This turns into a kind of resignation. Well, I'm not going to try and learn this new thing. But I went through that process, just like, you know, you break down the education of an individual from a young age, you know, grammar first, then logic, and then that can be turned into action and rhetoric. Well, when you're learning a new thing, yeah, it's grammar first. So all I have is this capture device that allows me to accept what's going on around me in a way that's not overwhelming, in a way that doesn't create stress, in a way that makes me available to the person that I'm trying to help, because I'm just capturing it. Okay, well, you know, we'll get to the next step of this later. Right now, as things come into my mind for the first time, I'm just identifying what they are. And once that is complete, I'm ready for what's next.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the act of helping someone, you actually help yourself. And this is an ongoing process in life. it's interesting you brought up Mark Passio, because I think he uses some wonderful analogies in the study of mind and the differentiation between mind and matter, the physical universe, and the way that we have our mental processes dealing with that physical universe. I hope that his work is known a little bit more, because, as I say, he's got a method of using the idea that we like stories to relate these abstract ideas. And he has a good background in mythology, which brings me to the idea that we have essentially three different ways of developing thought over the years. And the first one was this idea of mythology, of taking a phenomenon that we see in nature and trying to explain it. And so we make up people stories, essentially. And these people stand in, these personifications stand in for the phenomenon itself. And once the story is told, oftentimes we're satisfied. We think that we've taken although we don't explicitly think this necessarily, we think that we've taken the contradictions out of it. We understand possibly that we have explained something in nature, an action or a relationship. The what grows up is around a mythology is a priesthood or experts who continue to tell the story. They are sages who remember and tell the story over and over again. Well, you mentioned this earlier, that as a child, there are many things given to us that we don't question. And this whole idea in mythology is, okay, we've come to an understanding up to this point, but now we can't argue about any understanding we may have come further. We cannot argue with the mythology. It's set in stone. This authoritarian priesthood, this authoritarian bureaucracy has arisen around it. And so we cut to India, China, and Greece in ancient times, and they all came up with a different way of thinking, which was to pose questions. How do you pose the question? And rather than just giving answers, it's developing this method of questioning, a consistent method of questioning. And that's called the philosophical method of, there are essentially four branches. There are two that are really the crux of the entire process. But what's come to be called metaphysics, in ancient times it was called first philosophy. But metaphysics is just asking the biggest question that there is. What is?
Mm-hmm.
What is? What is all around us? What's in our mind? What is it that we perceive and conceive? What is? And then the second branch of it has another large technical word, which is epistemology. And this is the theory of knowledge. How do we know what is? This is where we start to realize that our five senses are our only contact with that which is around us. We're in contact with our own mind, but the external objective world are brought into our purview through our five senses. And in ancient times, the five physical senses, sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell, were studied much more intently than we do today. But these are part of the way that we come to know, the study of how do we come to know. And then particularly as it came out of the ancient period, we got into the idea of moral philosophy. Is once we have an inkling of what is, and we have an idea of how we've come to know, how do we use this information to live advantageously in a state of satisfaction and happiness with ourselves? How do we build self-confidence? And how do we live in groups? And in ancient times, this was another branch. Even today, it's called politics, that there's individual ethics and political ethics, or how to live in groups of people to the advantage of all. And of course, politics, like the word liberal, has been misused quite a bit. Today, indeed, politics is the exact opposite of anything ethical or moral. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the last branch, okay, we've asked and tried to answer, what is? How do we know what is, and how do we know that our answers are valid and true, epistemology? Then what do we do to live in a state of harmony and happiness with ourselves and what is? And finally, how do we communicate this, or aesthetics? And this is where the seven fine arts come in. This is where we express beauty in harmony with nature through the seven fine arts. So if we have created a beautiful piece of art, it is because it is true, therefore in harmony with nature. And of course, we can create pieces of art that have all kinds of negative connotations to us, or upon viewing it or experiencing it, many of us don't know what it is. Sometimes this takes study. So aesthetics is a fairly complex part, well, as are all parts of philosophy. But as we continue to use the trivium pattern to look at philosophy, we can advance our philosophies through time. And then finally, the last stage, because logic, this idea of systematically taking contradictions out of our viewpoint, was devised in logic, particularly by Aristotle in deductive logic, in his syllogism, we can now go on to looking at nature specifically, that is physical nature, and demonstrate our understanding. And if our understanding is compatible with the laws of nature, our experiment or our demonstration will go to place. If it's not in harmony, it will not go to place. So you use your trivium method again, go back to the grammar of your observations in the physical world, ask your question, hypothesize. This again goes back to the idea of using comparisons or that which you already have some understanding of to apply to this physical demonstration. And that's our third way of looking at our modes of knowledge. I call them the three modular pieces of knowledge: the mythological, the philosophical, and the scientific. I found that when I was working with home educating parents and students, that by their knowing of these three modes of knowledge and of the three ways that living beings have cognition, the way they cognate, seem to bring them into this, seem to open their mind enough to start looking at the trivium as being a valid method to bring understanding and useful knowledge to their children. So to come to know the way living things interact with their surroundings, there's stimulus response. And just about all living things, and here's another piece of wisdom I think that came out of antiquity, is the distinction between living and non-living. And particularly by the time we got up to Aristotle, he just simply used the idea of movement. And that which is inanimate or non-living requires an external force to move. The things that are animate can move themselves. They can either move their own appendages as a plant does. It can grow its roots. It can stretch its limbs. It can follow its leaves can follow the sun without an external energy pushing it, without anything working externally on it. And then you get up to the animal kingdom, and now you have a different type of motion, which is locomotion, which is going from one location to another. And that was the simple distinction. Aristotle just related everything to movement. So when we look at stimulus response, you can move the sun over a stationary rock laying on the earth, and the rock doesn't respond. But a plant, which is a photosynthetic plant, is green, will follow either its flowers or its leaves, will follow the sun across, making its path across the sky during the day. So that is its animation.
But I wonder how this relates to people or groups of people. When we're talking about, you know, three increasingly complex levels of consciousness, the first being this primary level, this stimulus response, it seems like there's, whatever the stimuli is, there's a programmed response, or whether it's programmed by nature or by something artificial. And there's no memory, there's no lesson of that stimulus-response relationship. Is it unfair to say that many people, and people especially in groups, behave this way at this very primary level of consciousness?
Not at all unfair.
Okay. I feel like it is, comparing people to plants. But, you know, it's just, you see so much of it.
Again, you've got to get into this mode of rather than... get into this idea of also and. Because mm-hmm. we do, as humans, being the most advanced level of living organism that we can observe on this planet, we have this. And this is what's been being given to us in school, and this is what control is all about, is giving you the stimulus and waiting for your response, or giving you an input. Let's go back to the computer, giving you an input and waiting for you to regurgitate an automatic or preconceived response, a memorized response. And that takes us to our second level. What we're missing, what we're not being given, is that intermediate stage of logic, of figuring it out for ourselves rather than taking the word of the authority. And we get used to it. We get lazy if we don't have this idea of validly and truthfully thinking for ourselves and learning on our own. But the next level up does include memory, and that really does, that's our perceptual level. And all animals have this idea of taking in information with their five senses and using that actively, sometimes proactively. There's a lot of animal life up to the reptilian and amphibious genuses that just have this stimulus response situation. They do everything intuitively. The mammal comes along, and now, particularly in rearing of their offspring, most of the reptiles and amphibians lay an egg and leave it, a fertilized egg, and that is the next generation of their species. The mammal comes along, and now memory is trying to be used, and I like the way you put that, to learn lessons. We, as mammals, want to learn lessons. And in order to start to teach, the mother now has emotions. She now has feelings or emotions for the child, so that child has an extended childhood in which to learn basic models from the parent. And then as you get higher, so-called higher into the mammalian genus, this memory work and teach and learn become more and more obvious. And the motivation behind it all is this idea of emotion. That's what motivates us. So that's our step in motivation. And this is really where we spend most of our time as humans, in this perceptual level of taking in the perceptions from our surroundings. This is the beginning of our mental life. It's really looking out there, seeing what's around us, tasting what's around us, feeling what's around us, etc., etc. And this is where we live. We live in this, first of all, stimulus response. Then we bring in our emotions to motivate. And all of this is pretty much automatic. We learn by trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And now we start, we have this need to communicate. And this is where the conceptual level, which in my youth, it was the understanding that humans were the only ones who had this conceptual level of thinking voluntarily. Your percepts are not voluntary. They're automatic. As is stimulus response. Open your eyes and you see. A noise is made and you can't help but hear it. a pressure right. is felt on your body. These are all automatic. But these make an impression. A number of those make an impression which are held in memory. And you start to relate what that impression was within the context of what your activity or your relationship was at that point. Well, now you come up to the human level of the conceptual, where you take a number of those percepts, a number of those perceptual instances, and start to model them before they happen, or they haven't happened as such. But you can proactively, through by choice, model this mentally, and then go test yourself in reality. And again, this goes to the scientific method, it goes to psychology, and it goes to mythology. Are you in harmony with what is? Are you in harmony with the physical universe around you? Are you in harmony with your own mental state? And this has been the development. So this idea of coming up to this conceptual level, which you are in charge of, you have the yay or nay say to use it or not. To use it effectively, you can reflect what nature has given you. This power of observation, the power of removing contradictions, and finally to use it effectively in the real world, to use what you've known in the real world.
And it grows from there, because once you're able to form some concepts, you know, you can start putting together new concepts from the previously established concepts, and from there you can replicate that process again and again and again, and you're learning.
You're learning and doing. Yeah. Concepts are abstractions. They live in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the power of our mind, of the conceptual mind, the abstractive mind, is building, as you just mentioned, abstractions from other abstractions, new concepts from already devised concepts. And this is the power of the human. And it all starts with his putting together the grammar with which to bring understanding to this mass of data.
Before we wrap up the grammar piece, can we just make a distinction between special grammar and general grammar? Obviously, grammar has taken on a certain meaning in the English language as far as how it's used and for what it is used.
Special grammar relates to a specific language or anything with its own lexicon, like a specialized science, like the science of biology or the science of physics. They each have their own lexicon, as do individual languages, ancient and modern languages. So special grammar relates to the words within that lexicon. General grammar are actually the rules that have been observed of grammar itself, or how do we think. So the greatest expression of grammar can be summed up in asking one question, or actually defining a situation, and that definition is the definition of existence itself. And existence is every substance, action, attribute, and relationship that is, was, or ever will be. And to express that grammatically, and we'll cover this with when we get to Aristotle and his mm-hmm. categories, his 10 categories. But that can be expressed grammatically by saying existence is every noun, verb, adjective and adverb, and prepositional phrase that ever was, is, or ever will be. So those are all the categorematic, that term, categorematic, was devised by the medieval scholastics who studied mm-hmm. Aristotle. And then a disciple of Ayn Rand, who you're familiar with as well, named Leonard Peikoff, called those concepts or words of consciousness. And then syncategorematic words are things that streamline thought, that streamline the categories, that make them more efficient. And those are actual prepositions themselves, the words that prepositions are made from, objects, or they just don't come to me now, Brett. At that, let me put this together for another time. But let's leave it at that. That general grammar are the rules of grammar itself, whereas special grammar are the rules of a particular language or a particular discipline.
So we are going to conclude there for today. By now, you know what will be coming in the next installment of this series. If you have questions or comments, please feel free to share them at schoolsucksproject.com in the comment form on this episode's page. Thanks again, and take care.